This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, April 27th, 2011. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large, Roby Brock from Talk Business will talk with Jay Barth, political scientist at Hendricks College, about the latest Talk Business poll that gives results about what Arkansans think of the Arkansas legislature, Governor Mike Beebe, and other political figures. Plus, Arkansas Western Ballet readies Alice in Wonderland, and you can make a film for Artisphere. All of that ahead on Ozarks at Large, but first,
tomorrow morning at 10:15 Central, millions of Americans will drop, cover, and hold on, as prescribed by the Great Central U.S. Shakeout. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Earthquake shakeout drills were first conducted in California in 2008 to prepare residents living along the San Andreas earthquake fault. A year later, nearly 7 million people participated. But this will be the first time 11 mid-American states will take part in the Great Central U.S. Shakeout. Brian Blake is Earthquake Program Director for the Central Earthquake Consortia.
The funding comes from primarily the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the U.S. Geological Survey, the National Science Foundation, and also the states where the shakeout is taking place. And there's a lot of organizations scattered throughout that are contributing.
Until several years ago, we didn't think much about earthquakes in Arkansas. That is until several small quakes shook Benton County in the northwestern part of the state, and a swarm erupted in Faulkner County. All of that shifted residents' awareness. But really, this civil emergency drill is all about the New Madrid Seismic Zone, a major earthquake hazard that threatens eastern Arkansas, Missouri, Illinois, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Mississippi. In the winter of 1811 and 12, a series of massive quakes were centered at New Madrid, Missouri. To this day, it's considered one of the most powerful earthquakes in U.S. history and remains the subject of intense study, debate, and speculation. According to the historical record, four earthquakes collapsed buildings and liquefied the ground. And certain seismologists say another quake is imminent. But Brian Blake says other earthquake hazards exist in the southeastern United States as well.
South Carolina, we've got a pretty big fault system there that produced a very large earthquake in the late 1800s. There's a fault zone in East Tennessee and northeastern Alabama that can produce damaging earthquakes. And the last, they actually had a minor earthquake event there in 2003 that did some damage in northeastern Alabama. In southwestern Indiana and southeastern Illinois, the Wabash Valley seismic zone, which can produce very large earthquakes as well, even upwards of a magnitude 7 earthquake, which is a pretty big event.
So emergency planners thought it might be time to acclimate Midwestern residents to earthquake drills.
The drill is really pretty simple. It's designed to teach people how to react when the ground starts to shake from an earthquake. And so we're going to have people at 10:15 a.m. on April 28th practice drop, cover, and hold on. And that is drop to the floor before an earthquake drops you and take cover under a sturdy object like a desk or a table and hold on to it until the shaking stops.
Do your drill like you practiced.
Earthquake!
Root Elementary School in Fayetteville is participating, including this class who on cue dive under their desks.
All clear.
Three students are leading the program, collectively called Root Elementary Shakeout Team.
I'm Alan Wang, and I'm in fourth grade, and I'm 10 years old.
I'm Jan Bobden, and I'm 10 years old, and I'm in fourth grade.
I'm Junior Samuels. I'm in fourth grade, and I'm 10 years old.
All three boys are English as second language students and were studying earthquakes when they came across the national drill. Jan Bobda.
And we looked at the website, and we asked our principal if we could participate in the shakeout. She allowed us, and then we signed up.
Junior Samuel said current events initiated it.
We all researched about the tsunami in Japan, and so we all started talking about earthquakes, and that's how we came up about the shakeout.
And Alan Wang says our proximity places us at risk.
We live in the New Madrid Fault Zone, where the earthquake happens.
Word of the drill has spread. More than 200 schools are participating in Arkansas. Joey Folsom is principal at Butterfield Trail Elementary. She says they've not formally practiced.
We have not. We told the teachers about it, and I'm not sure some individual teachers may have done that in their classrooms, but we will probably just use this as a drill, and we'll observe and see how everybody does, and then we always ask for feedback after it's over just to make sure everybody understood how to do it.
Is it creating a lot of curiosity among teachers and students?
I really think just given the knowledge of the earthquakes that have happened recently, that it's not anyone surprised about it, and it's just, and we're familiar with fire drills, we're familiar with lockdowns, we're familiar with tornado drills, and the building evacuation drills. And so everybody just kind of knows that we have things in place for as many crises that might come up. And so the earthquake is not any, I mean, you know, like I said, because of the recent earthquake activity, I don't think anybody's taken back by the fact that we would have an earthquake drill.
Do you think these kinds of things alarm the children, or they just take it in stride?
They take it in stride.
Principal Folsom says drills will likely lead to safer behavior.
Well, it's real important to have the children knowledgeable about what they're supposed to do, and then that's how you keep them from being so alarmed when real things happen, and for staff and to be prepared for these, because when you're dealing with the safety of 500-plus students, it's quite a responsibility, and we need to be in the know on what we're supposed to do.
Seven colleges and universities are also taking part, including UALR and Northwest Arkansas Community College. The University of Arkansas at Fayetteville is not. Last week, U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan and Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano encouraged all educational institutions across the country to participate in preparedness drills, but many other groups are as well. Central Earthquake Consortia Director Brian Blake.
The states that are participating are South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois. So we've got 11 states, and the different participants that we've got signed up so far really are a range of folks. Primarily, it's school kids. We've got about 2.3 million participants in schools. That's school teachers, students, faculty, and staff. But we've also got several hundred thousand participants, individuals, businesses, state government, you know, local government, medical facilities, retirement communities or homeowners associations. You know, it's really open to everyone. It's free and open to the public. We don't discourage anyone from practicing.
The Great Central U.S. Shakeout also advises residents to take additional safety measures, assess building weaknesses, secure objects that may tip over, like televisions, bookcases, appliances, and furniture, and create a family emergency plan, including disaster kits, stockpile food and water, have flashlights on hand, as well as a portable radio and first aid. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And if you'd like to learn more, you can visit shakeout.org/centralus. That's shakeout.org/centralus. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas legislature is done with its work. Only the formality of officially ending the session is left. And the latest Talk Business Hendricks College poll asked 582 voters in Arkansas about the job legislators did, the job Governor Mike Beebe is doing, and a few other politically related questions. Respondents gave the governor a thumbs up with a 67% approval rating. The 88th General Assembly received lower numbers. Only 29% of those responding gave the legislature an approval, while 41% answering say they disapproved of the legislature's job this winter and spring. 30% said they didn't know. And 29% of those polled say they approve of the congressional redistricting plan approved by the Arkansas legislature, while 47% say they dislike that new map. And the poll asked about the recent ruling by the Arkansas Supreme Court that upheld a lower court ruling dismissing Act 1, which prohibited cohabitating adults from being able to adopt or foster children. Nearly half of the respondents say they disapprove of that ruling. 38% say they favored the ruling by the state's high court. Roby Brock, the editor and publisher of Talk Business and the website talkbusiness.net, recently talked with Jay Barth, a professor of political science at Hendricks College, about the results of this latest poll.
Let's start with Senator Mark Pryor. He's not up for re-election until 2014, but we really haven't studied his approval in the past. With the numbers that you see in this survey, is Mark Pryor kind of suffering the same fate as Blanche Lincoln, kind of guilt by association as a Democrat at the federal level?
Well, I think to some degree he is. I think that he has become a polarizing figure basically because all things political, especially related to Washington, are now polarizing. That said, he's in a little bit better shape, I think, than Senator Lincoln was at this point in her re-election campaign, a couple years out. He has some wealth of popularity that comes from his family's name. He also, in looking below the top line numbers, he's doing a little better in Northwest Arkansas than most Democrats. He's got a little bit of benefit from overperformance there. Assuming he runs for re-election, though, I mean, I think we are going to see, a tough Republican opponent. I think there's no doubt about that. And I think the National Republican Party is going to see this as a winnable seat, mainly because of the poor performance of Democrats in national elections over the last couple of cycles.
Governor Mike Beebe remains immensely popular, as we have seen over the course of our year's worth of polling. Did the session and some of the partisanship on display affect him in your estimation?
It doesn't appear so. I mean, it appears that he just glided through once again, showing his talent as a politician, but the fact that he is this guy that all Arkansans like. And this thing is amazing. It crosses partisan lines. Majority of Republicans approve of the governor's performance. Obviously, overwhelming percentage of Democrats. It's geographically broad. It's across all groups. And he is, a guy who has turned into, I think we will probably see, maybe the most popular governor of all time in recent modern polling. Maybe Governor Pryor, Governor Bumpers was very popular throughout his governorship, but this guy is pretty magical as a politician.
Well, let's turn to the state legislature's significantly higher disapproval numbers and a perception that the Democrats are still in charge of state government, even though the ranks are really pretty close in terms of Republican and Democratic makeup. Is this dissatisfaction with the Democratic Party, or is there a split between those two questions that we asked?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a split between the two. I think on the who's in control, it's a difficult question, and I know we ask it to kind of see what changes had occurred in that question. I think it's the literal versus figurative control of state government. I think some Democrats would say, Democrats really don't have control. Other Republicans would say, no, Democrats do have control. It's also a little bit of a test of political knowledge because do Arkansans really know who their legislators are? It's a little hard to say exactly what's being tested there. I think it's a combination of all of those things, but clearly Republicans have more influence than they did 2 or 3 years ago. That's shown in the poll. That does indicate some some increase in the perception that Republicans have some real influence over the process. I think that the legislative question was very much directed over the last few months and what the performance had been. I think that it was a messy session, especially in those closing weeks related to congressional redistricting. And I think that there's some frustration. It was not the prettiest series of headlines for the legislature. It seemed to be a legislature that probably could have been more efficient at getting the relatively limited number of items on its agenda completed. And so some frustration, but I think it is also one of the things that comes with a divided, polarized legislature. It's not unlike what we see in terms of the attitudes about the U.S. Congress, is that people certainly don't want their voice shut out, but they also become frustrated if you have an overly partisan body. And for the first time in the Arkansas legislative history, really saw partisanship begin to trump other forces that have typically mattered a lot more, like geography. So that was interesting. It was new. And I think that the legislature came out of that session with some struggles. And I think looking forward, I think we have to be a little worried about Arkansans' perception of the legislature, because I don't know that much is going to change in the coming years.
A surprisingly low number of voters were undecided with their opinions on the congressional redistricting plan that the legislature approved. It was certainly in the headlines a lot. Were you surprised by that, number one? And number two, what does a high disapproval of that plan kind of signal for next year's elections to you?
Yeah, I was very surprised. I, really thought that was an inside baseball game story. It had gotten a lot of attention on blogs. It had certainly got newspaper coverage. But I thought it was probably a pretty inside baseball deal. I thought possibly up in the 3rd District it would be a lot better known because of the attention that the Fayetteville Finger had over those closing weeks. And then the final plan, of course, also breaks up that old 3rd District. So I was surprised that people seemed to be paying some attention to that story and seemed to not like it. And I think that it was, I would say, kind of the overt partisanship that was shown at times in that story, and also just the kind of the messiness and what appeared to be some inefficiency by state government. The legislature stayed in session a lot longer to deal with that issue. They couldn't seem to get anything done for a couple of weeks. I think that was what I think kind of frustrated Arkansans about the story. I'm not convinced that it's so much the map that was drawn, but the process that led to that map.
And when you look at the congressional elections next year, which are arguably going to be among the highest profile races in the state, how do you see this new congressional district map playing out? Kind of take me through the 4 congressional districts and where you think that we're going to see the most change.
Yeah, and Swing State Project, which is an online political blog, had a very good analysis earlier this week comparing the McCain-Obama race in 2008 in the old districts with the new districts. And all in all, very little change. Is that the Democrats really did not take advantage of their position of power to really change the landscape dramatically. I think that the 1st district is the district that has changed the most in terms of its political dynamics. It's marginal change, but in a close race, that marginal change may be very significant. Congressman Crawford is running for re-election the first time. The first time out for re-election is always a challenging situation for a member of Congress. And he has added to his district several counties in the Delta, the southern part of the district, areas where he's not run before and are quite a ways away from his home in Craighead County. I think that is a challenge for him to, the first time out, go out into some new turf. And those are, unfriendly voters to Democrats. I do think that the 2012 election cycle, while the president is very unpopular in Arkansas, the one place where Democrats really might be able to mobilize support for President Obama that would benefit Congressman Crawford would be in those heavily African-American counties in the Delta. So I think that's the lay of the land in the 1st district. The 2nd district, almost no change. A little whittling, but really almost no change. I think Congressman Griffin, who won easily 2 years ago, is in very solid shape coming back for re-election in 2012. The 3rd district. No change in terms of its composition, some change in the way it looks, but not in its composition. The fourth district, of course, dramatic change in the way it looks, which with, of course, the big thumb up into northwest Arkansas. But assuming Congressman Ross went for re-election, probably not much change in that cycle politically. I think moving forward, the 4th District suddenly becomes a much more interesting district because of its geographical diversity and because it is a district that has shown some willingness in national elections to vote Republican.
All right, Jay, we asked another question in our poll about the implementation of federal health care at the state level. Kind of a surprising result to me since we've seen so much resistance to health care reform in the state. A higher number of Arkansans actually support the state implementing health care changes to avoid the federal government doing it for us, and they preferred that over waiting for the federal courts to make a decision on the law's constitutionality. Kind of what was your take?
Well, I do think this was a framing that was pretty effective by the Democrats in this session, in that they really tried to tap into Arkansas's kind of inherent provincialism and a resistance to the feds coming in and telling us how to do things. And that's, of course, a long tradition in Arkansas history with arguably some good moments and some pretty bad moments, such as the Little Rock Central crisis. But there is this kind of sense of, you know, Arkansans know best about Arkansas. And I think that was a very effective frame for the Democrats. It showed majority support both among Democrats and Republicans. And I think that sense of provincialism, localism, we know what's best for us, is a very effective frame moving forward. And so I think the Democrats are wise to continue to play that as they put forward proposals to go ahead and move forward with the implementation. So that was, I thought that question was, I didn't know what the results would be because I didn't know what the balance would be between those two. What appeared to be pretty strong frames, obviously a resistance to so-called Obamacare, which is pretty unpopular in Arkansas, but this local control really trumping that.
And finally, we asked about the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Act One, the law that passed in 2008. It prohibited unmarried cohabitating couples from adopting children. Not a surprising poll result against the court overturning that law, since it passed by an overwhelming margin from voters, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, slight right at 50%, maybe just over 50%, opposed the court's decision. I believe the support for Act 1 in 08 was 57%. So that does indicate, you know, some lessening of support for the measure. I think that these results, while indicating some opposition to the ruling, I would say don't give a lot of credence to a constitutional amendment. I mean, those numbers probably need to be a little bit bigger for any kind of real electoral effort to undo that court ruling. But it does indicate that the court may have been a little bit out in front of the people of Arkansas on that issue. And I think that's not unsurprising. Courts are often out ahead of public opinion, but it does potentially show a little bit of attitude change over the last few years on that issue.
Jay Barth is a professor of political science at Hendricks College. He talked with Roby Brock from Talk Business earlier this week. More information about the Talk Business Hendricks College poll can be found online at talkbusiness.net.
Support for content for talkbusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at BankOzarks.com. And Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon communication store or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness. This is Ozarks at Large. The floodgates at Beaver and Table Rock Lake dams opened late Monday after the region received over a foot of rainfall. Lori Driver is a public affairs specialist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Little Rock District.
Beaver Lake has received a tremendous amount of rainfall in the last week. Inflows have been in the 120 to 130,000 cubic feet per second range. That has finally slowed down, and we are cutting back on our releases this morning since we have crested the Beaver Pool.
Runoff continues to pour into the watershed, but authorities say the situation is easing. And some flooding has occurred below Beaver Dam. Jason Morris, director of Carroll County Emergency Management, said this morning no residents living along the tailwaters of Beaver Dam had to evacuate, but two homes received minor flooding.
The White River flows north into Missouri through a chain of lakes, including Table Rock, Taneycomo, and the upper portions of Bull Shoals, and curves south back into eastern Arkansas, where it drains into the Delta. Table Rock floodgates are still wide open, according to Driver.
Table Rock has received more than 13 inches of rain for April and more than 10 inches of rain during the storm this last week. A lot of that rain was uncontrolled runoff below the dam, and Lake Taneycomo and Branson itself was inundated a day or so ago, which forced the Corps of Engineers to hold their releases until flooding subsided some. We have stepped up our releases since the uncontrolled runoff has cleared up some, and we are currently releasing, at Table Rock, we are currently releasing 68,000 cubic feet per second, and will remain that until we reduce Table Rock to the top of the flood pool, which is elevation 931. Table Rock is currently at elevation 934.94.
Since the 31,000-acre impoundment was built in the 1960s, Beaver Dam floodgates have been open fewer than a dozen times. And yesterday, U.S. Geological Survey field crews measured an all-time record flooding on the Illinois River in northwest Arkansas.
It's Wednesday, April 27th, 2011. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And joining us now is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
So what's up?
Not much. What's up with you? Oh, no, that's the wrong answer.
Right.
The right answer is that an exhibition of graphic designs is showcased at the University of Arkansas Fine Arts Center Gallery this week. The artist's name is Sylvia Cottis, and the graphic designs are put together like a neighborhood food store. It's called Small Footprint.
Well, this sounds very interesting, very compelling.
Opened yesterday. It's open through May 5th. And you know where the University of Arkansas Fine Arts Center Gallery is. There's no excuse for you not to go there and see Othello while you're there. The artist reception is from 4 to 6 o'clock today. And then you can roll on over to the 8 o'clock performance of University Theater's Othello.
Yep, you don't even have to roll. You can just
waddle.
Right. I mean, it's right there.
Stroll, crawl, yes. Creep, whatever you'd like to do.
I think a couple of hops will get you there.
No, that was last weekend.
Okay.
And there's also an evening of chamber music with the University of Arkansas Fort Smith musicians at 7:30 at 2nd Street Live in Fort Smith.
A wonderful venue.
And that's free.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
I wouldn't make this up.
No, I know.
I'm done.
Okay, Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Point shoes pound the floor as Western Arkansas ballet dancers twirl about the studio. They're rehearsing the fall down the rabbit hole scene for the company's April 30th performance of Alice in Wonderland. Melissa Schoenfeld is the executive artistic director for Western Arkansas Ballet.
This ballet is based more on the book than it is like the Disney movie or the Johnny Depp movie, and the story itself lends so much to interpretation between Alice in Wonderland and Alice in the Look Through the Looking Glass, you know. So bringing all that together and then finding the music that tells a story all the way through. It's been interesting, you know, putting all that together.
Schoenfeld is choreographing the performance and says it's been fun expanding her imagination in order to create her own interpretation of the story. However, at times, it can also feel like a daunting task.
In some ways, because it's so new, it is kind of like, oh my gosh, what have I bitten off here? But once you get into it, and you know, you're thinking about, okay, if the flowers came alive, what would they be like? And you know, then you read the book. How did the flowers treat Alice when she was in the Garden of the Living Flowers? And so you kind of go that direction.
Western Arkansas Ballet is a nonprofit academy and regional ballet company who organizes 2 paid performances annually. The organization is currently celebrating its 25th anniversary.
We teach ages 4 through adult in, we have ballet, tap, jazz, modern, Pilates. But when they're at the age of 11, if they're interested in doing ballet company, they audition, they take an audition class. We do that in the spring. And if you're accepted into the company, there's different levels to the company depending on your technique level. And you're accepted into the company, you take classes 3 to 4 days a week, plus rehearsal time. You are, if you're a company member in good standing, you get to be in all our performances. So, also, Western Arkansas Ballet is one of 2 regional ballet companies in Arkansas that are members of Regional Dance America, which is a national organization. The other Arkansas company is Arkansas Festival Ballet in Little Rock. Yeah, and Regional Dance America is a national organization. It's divided up into 5 different regions. We're members of the Southwest region, and we have a festival every year that the kids get to go take class, and they perform for each other and that kind of thing. So, and in 2013, we're going to host Regional Dance America Festival here in Fort Smith.
The festival will feature 25 regional companies. Students will take class during the day and then host public performances in the evening. As a nonprofit, the organization relies on volunteers, for whom Schoenfeld is very grateful.
We have 4 paid staff members, and after that, it's totally volunteers. So we appreciate our volunteers, appreciate our staff. It's a great staff. But our volunteers, they do everything from helping to build props, costuming, painting sets, all kinds of stuff.
Schoenfeld is celebrating her 23rd year with the organization. She says she's been dancing since the age of 3, and she took the position as executive artistic director after earning her master's degree in ballet and teaching from the University of Oklahoma.
It's something I've always done, but I love to do it. I love to see the aha moments in little kids. In kids, it's like they finally get it. They achieve something, so you get to see that little light bulb come on, and then they want to do more. So it's exciting, and it doesn't happen every day or every class. So, yeah, just working that.
The company has been rehearsing since February for the upcoming performance, which is being dedicated to the memory of former Fort Smith Mayor Ray Baker.
It's just our way of appreciating what he did for the arts here in Fort Smith. He was a huge cheerleader and proponent of the arts here in Fort Smith, and so he's always been close to our hearts, so we wanted to make sure that we honored him in this way.
The performance is scheduled for 7:30 p.m. April 30th at the Arkansas Best Corporation Performing Arts Center. Tickets are available for $20 and $25. Schoenfeld says the ballet will give audiences a new way to see this classic story.
To see a different interpretation of Alice in Wonderland, and it's such a fun story, and it's very imaginative. It's like, you know, when you're talking about the Tweedles and, you know, the Cheshire Cat and Alice and all the different characters that are in the ballet, to see the story in dance form and not in spoken or written word.
More information is available at waballet.org or 479-785-0152. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
After this week's torrential rains, the floods, and the tornadoes, you may have had all the interaction with nature you want for a while. But the second Artisphere Festival encourages a gentler relationship, asking us to consider how nature and art relate. There is a festival orchestra made up of musicians from around the country and around the world. There are lectures, visual arts opportunities, and musical performance of almost every type. And there's a film contest. The Grow a Film Project, Nature as a Third Place contest, invites experienced and inexperienced filmmakers to create a small movie that might someday sprout into a bigger piece. Jules Taylor and Jason Sewell are the creative and executive directors of the project, respectively. They came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about the film competition. Jules Taylor says she wants entries from all levels of would-be directors.
There's a lot of different parts to it. It's really a large project. The main part of it is a contest for filmmakers. I hesitate to say filmmakers because I don't want to turn anybody away. It's for everybody.
Anybody can do this. The requirements are not that so involved that you couldn't grab a camera or even grab your phone and go out and film something and submit it.
A little flip camera would be great even at this point. What we're asking for this time is a 5 to 10 minute piece of film that shows or gives an idea of what an expanded version of that film would be.
So not quite a pilot for a television show, but a pitch, filmed pitch.
A pitch. Ooh.
That's a good word, yeah. Exactly. And we're the Walton Arts Center and us are working together on this, and we're giving out cash prizes to those people who come in third, second, and first place. So obviously those films are going to be juried and decide on – we can talk about the criteria maybe in a moment, but the films that best fit the criteria then will be awarded. And that first place film not only gets $300 just as pocket money to go home with, but an additional $500 to expand their film to be used all over the place with Artisphere 2012. So next year's Artisphere will hopefully have a longer version of the film, and the Walton Arts Center is going to plan to use this film, you know, with all of their publicity and in other places as well.
So say I submit a 5 to 10 minute movie, which is the nugget of an idea, and I win. Now, do I have to keep that same 5 to 10 minutes of footage, or can I? No. So this is just to show the judges
what the idea is.
Gotcha.
So what we are anticipating, obviously, is that if you do win, that idea is what you expand into the longer film. But you certainly don't have to keep the same footage. You could make your film even like a narrative. So if you give us your footage and it's almost like a documentary about what you're going to feature in our area, then you could do a narrative then for 40 minutes at a later time when you expand it.
So you want it to be clever.
Yes.
You want it to catch attention.
Of course.
It's with Artisphere, and as we mentioned, the seedling and the grow of film has Artisphere. Does the film itself have to have a particularly nature theme?
Well, there's a few, and we can get into these, there's a few film criteria that we want to have. First of all, people should know that it's open to all ages, so anyone can feel free to submit. And it must relate thematically to a book and a theory called Nature as the Third Place. And if you go on to seedlingfilm.com or if you go on to the Walton Arts Center's page about this, there's more information there. But basically, it's talking about exploring nature, just as we've talked about. There's really no need to, spend all day reading a book about it. That's what it's about.
It's a sociological concept of nature as the third place. The idea is that there's three places in our life where we spend our time: home, work, and then a social environment. Hmm. So what this gentleman, Ray Odenkirk, is suggesting is that we take our third place, our social place, and connect it with nature. That doesn't mean necessarily that it has to be outside, but there's some sort of a connection with nature. Mm-hmm. And that obviously is kind of a broad concept. You can find a lot of different connections in that way. Not just, you know, I'm going to sit by a tree. There's a lot of different other ideas that you can find. I know that one filmmaker is talking about doing a piece that's based around one of the social, the senior centers in our area. Hmm. And so I'm pretty sure she's not saying that she wants to do it about their grounds necessarily, more about the people who are at the social center, and then finding a way to find what their lives are like to relate it to nature.
Yeah, and that lends itself nicely to another one of the criteria, which is that it must feature an identifiable landmark of
Arkansas.
So anything really, anything dealing with Arkansas. So we've opened this up not only to Northwest Arkansas filmmakers and the film community here and just interested parties, but it's been released to the entire state. And even those who dip into it, we send an email out to a person living up in Missouri, filmmaker might drop down film, you know, capture some footage of something in Northwest Arkansas and then continue to make the film from that. So that's another one of the criteria.
And the landmark itself doesn't need to be outside, doesn't need to be, you know, the tree or the rocks or the river, which it certainly could be, but it also could just be any identifiable Arkansas landmark.
When I submit my film, do I submit with this a thesis or a defense that suggests maybe the original judges don't think this is a landmark, but I can explain why it is?
I think that would be certainly helpful. It's not required by any means, but it probably would be really helpful when you submit, maybe, especially if it looks like it's not obvious right away.
Like if I said that aquarium inside Herman's Rib House.
Right.
I think that's a landmark. But if it's just in the film, it might not, but I would suggest why.
You could suggest why, absolutely. Okay. And because the jurors are going to be looking at those, how well you met those criteria, you might want to do a little explanation. Mm-hmm. If it's something specific like that that's not identifiable, you know, to everyone, it's not Reynolds Razorback Stadium.
Or Old Main or Hawksbill Crag or something like that. Now, those are some of the requirements, but then you have some things that should take the environment into consideration. There are five things, and you pick two of those.
Correct.
In the actual making of the film.
Right.
That's correct.
We're really focusing on a new movement in the film industry of sustainable filmmaking, which, of course, everybody is focusing on sustainability in pretty much every aspect of our lives right now. But in the film industry, people are focusing on making the film more sustainable in the actual producing it. So some of the criteria would be like getting the sets and the costumes from a thrift store. Carpooling. Using bicycles to get to your location. Shooting on digital rather than using film.
People still use film?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But making a carbon neutral experience?
As low carbon output as possible.
And part of our requirements, I mean, like you said, there are five things listed there, and you have to choose two of those things. There's some that are more easy to do, and there's some that are more difficult, but you know, we're open to whatever. And we took a lot of our information here from our friends at Hearth Creative, who have made a film on a sustainable budget, and they filmed in Tulsa. The film is called The Rock and Roll Dreams of Duncan Christopher.
Oh, you're going to show that at the kickoff.
Show that. That's right. And the filmmaker is going to be there as part of the panel to discuss sustainable filmmaking. So Jewel said it was complicated, and it sort of is, because we have this – you're able to make these films all the way starting now until they have to be submitted by May the 18th in order for them to be juried and everything like that. So that is open. Then there are two events dealing with this specifically, and the first one is sort of what we're calling the kickoff event, which is May the 7th. And at that event, it starts at 7 o'clock, I believe. Is that correct? 7 to 11 that night. Yeah, we're going to be at Nadine Baum Studios. And so we've got a panel of people in the filmmaking industry talking about sustainable filmmaking. We're going to screen that very film, The Rock and Roll Dreams of Duncan Christopher, which was shot completely, you know, in sustainable filmmaking practices. And we're going to see that film. And then afterwards, after that, sort of the cherry on top, the crowning achievement, if you will, of that evening will be a karaoke party, because the film is based around some karaoke stars. And one of those karaoke personalities is making his way over from Tulsa to spend the evening with us, entertaining us. And he is something else. You really got to see this character. Mm-hmm.
Simply Irresistible is his name.
Okay.
Sometimes he goes by The Dragon.
Yeah, he's really, really something. So we're really excited, like Jason said.
What if I'm going to enter this, should I be more concerned about my story, my production values?
I think at this point the production values are not necessarily of issue for us in any way. What we're looking for right now with this 5 to 10 minute piece is the idea of what it would be if you could expand it. Okay. You know, and the idea is that once you have a little bit more support from the Walton Arts Center and from Seedling, then the production values would probably heighten up. But right now, we're really looking more for the film.
We're looking for that seed of an idea.
May 18th is the deadline.
May 18th is the deadline for the films.
People want to know more, because we've talked about some of the criteria, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. Where can they go?
Seedlingfilm.com.
Or artistfearfestival.org.
Yeah, the information is readily available on both of those websites. And then the listeners should know as well that when we're going to be announcing the winners is happening on May the 27th. So that is also at Nadine Baum Studios, and we'll be having a ceremony to announce who has won.
Right, as well as on that night, we'll also screen the top five entries and have an audience choice award that happens that night.
Kickoff on the 7th, deadline 18th, announcement and screening on the 27th.
Correct.
All right. And then next year we see hopefully the expanded version.
It's a really incredible opportunity. The exposure, I think, is going to be amazing for an individual or even for a group. I'm encouraging groups to submit things because I think the exposure will be great next year.
And the key here is to think big. You're not just making a short film. You are making the seed of a longer film.
Right. Correct.
So don't make an 8-minute film that is all self-contained and has nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jules Taylor is creative director and Jason Sewell is executive director of the Grow a Film Project Nature as the Third Place Film Competition in conjunction with Artisphere. The contest kicks off May 7th in Nadine Baum Studios in Fayetteville, and the deadline for submissions is May 18th. For more information, seedlingfilm.com or artisphearfestival.org.
And this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And it's time for our question of the day. You have probably heard by now that President Obama, earlier today, released his birth certificate.
Mm-hmm.
That brings us to a question about presidential birth certificates.
Okay.
There are several states that have had just one president born inside them, including Arkansas. Bill Clinton was born in Hope. So today's question is about another state that's only had one president born inside its borders.
Okay.
The question is, who is the only president to have Illinois as his birthplace on his birth certificate? Is it Abraham Lincoln, Ronald Reagan, or James Buchanan?
If you have a guess or you know the answer, give us a call at 1-800-522-KUAF.
And again, the question, who is the only president to have Illinois as his place of birth on his birth certificate? Is it Abraham Lincoln, Ronald Reagan, or James Buchanan?
Call with the answer, and today you could win...
Well, we're going to have two winners.
Okay.
We have two pairs of tickets to see Lucinda Williams and Billy Joe Shaver at the Amp Sunday night. So,
Two
chances to win. All the correct answers go in the ceramic cow. And after that, we'll pull two people out of the cow.
Good luck.
Time now to answer today's question, which was, who is the only president to have Illinois on his birth certificate as his place of birth? The choices, Abraham Lincoln, Ronald Reagan, or James Buchanan. And the answer?
Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan. Illinois is the land of Lincoln, but as anybody in Kentucky will tell you, which is where I was this last weekend, Abraham Lincoln was born in Kentucky. The only president to be born in Kentucky. James Buchanan, the only president to be born inside Pennsylvania.
All right, then.
Ronald Reagan, the answer. So we will pick two winners.
Two winners today.
For each, we'll win a pair of tickets to Lucinda Williams and Billy Joe Shaver at the Amp tomorrow. Two more chances to win tickets to see Lucinda Williams Sunday night at the Amp.
Yes.
So keep listening, and thanks for playing.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Montanay, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 26 years. You can listen online at our website, KUAF.com.
You can also find past editions of Ozarks at Large at our website, OzarksAtLarge.com. And Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Another brand new edition tomorrow at noon. Plus tomorrow, your chance again to win two tickets to listen to Williams at the Amp Sunday night. Thanks for listening. Have
a great day.